The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt at Studio Winterfell. It is our anniversary show. 40 years yesterday, married to the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. 22 years yesterday, launched the Hugh Hewitt Show. So we've begun our 23rd year on the show and our 41st year of marriage with the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. I could not have a better guest than former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, because he knows my lovely wife and he knows that she's just as wonderful as his is. Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning and happy anniversaries to you.
Thank you. I wanted to talk to you especially, and thank you for getting the time this morning, because of the assassination of former Prime Minister Abe and then the elections that followed and what it means. First, tell us about the Prime Minister. One of the shocking events. I've been off for 5 days. It doesn't happen in Japan.
It's really something. I was heartbroken to see it. Obviously, we pray for him and for his family. And the people of Japan, who lost an amazing leader and a partner to America. He was someone who, when I interacted with him, I've known him since 2015, since he spoke to the joint session of Congress. I got a chance to meet him as a backbench member of Congress from Kansas. And then got to know him as CIA director and secretary of state. He was always honest with us, straightforward, quiet in his voice, but very, very sincere and direct in how he thought about the world, the threat from the Chinese Communist Party, and making sure he protected the people of Japan, too. He knew that the understandings from the post-World War II era were dated. He was aiming to fix it, and he wanted America's partner to help do that.
He was very clear-eyed about President Xi and the CCP, and the election yesterday gave his party the 75% supermajority it needs to amend the Constitution. Will you welcome that, because it will allow Japan to rearm after 75 years of being a quasi-pacifist state?
Yes, this would be a good thing for the people of Japan, for the people of the Western Pacific, the folks that Abe understood needed to change the way they thought about their own security environment. And if they do that, then America will be a great partner in assisting them that. We will be able to establish the deterrence that Abe wanted. He wanted to deter the Chinese Communist Party. He didn't want to fight them. He didn't want war. He wanted to establish a set of understandings that were based on the rule of law, protected the things that belonged to Japan, and then help other nations in the region do the same for themselves. It would be a good thing if they amended that constitution. It'll obviously be up to the leadership there. But to have the capacity to deter aggression is something every sovereign nation is required to have.
Now, Mr. Secretary, you spent some time in the United Kingdom in the run-up to the announcement by Prime Minister Johnson that he will be standing down and the launch of the UK leadership election. Now, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom matters a great deal to the United States. And you've known a lot of their foreign secretaries, your counterpart when you were at the CIA at M6. You know a lot of these people. What do you make of the needs of Great Britain in their next prime minister?
Toughness, resolve, candor, most of all, candor to the people of the United Kingdom, telling them that this is a tough, ornery world out there, that they are an important player in it. Now that they are no longer part of Europe, they need to step up and continue the kind of leadership that they had when President Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and Pope John Paul II worked so closely together. I was there. I was in London for 3 or 4 days just before Prime Minister Johnson stepped down. And I saw a great generation of next conservative leaders from the Tory party. Not every Tory is a conservative, but every conservative is a Tory. And I think they will find a good leader who moves the country forward in a way that engages in the world economically. It lets London continue to be a massively important financial center, but provides a level of understanding for other European nations about this is the way forward.
Mr. Secretary, I know you dealt with Boris Johnson and with Theresa May and with many secretaries of defense and ministers of defense. I was hoping Ben Wallace would throw his hat into the ring, and he has declined to do so. What is the clarity that the United Kingdom needs vis-a-vis Ukraine, especially? Boris Johnson embodied a lot of physical courage, by visiting Ukraine. What do we need the next UK prime minister to do vis-a-vis Ukraine? They're all running on tax cuts, but I want to see what they're going to do about their nuclear subs and the Ukraine.
Well, every leader runs on building a good economy so families have the things that they need. Frankly, one of the failures of European leadership over the last decade has been to get sucked into this green idea that said you can rely on Russian energy as your transition. And it put them all in a really, really tough place. Good news, United Kingdom least amongst them. They're not in as bad a place as France and Germany. The next UK leader needs to understand that. Doesn't surprise me they're all running. I'm glad to see they're running on tax cuts since Boris had passed the windfall profits tax, which is a fundamentally unconservative idea. As for Ukraine, they are going to have to continue what Boris spoke about but didn't deliver on in the way that he needed to, the same way President Biden has spoke about it but hasn't delivered. We need to support the Ukrainian effort to protect their sovereignty, to push back and actually push Putin in a place that forces him to get out of this thing on terms that are good for the Ukrainian people and bad for Vladimir Putin. I hope that that next leader will do it. Some of them have. Liz Truss has. Tom Tugin had asked. There's a handful. I don't want to skip any names. But there are a handful of Tory leaders who are putting themselves in the ring. It is unfortunate about their defense minister. He is a fantastic guy and understands Ukraine in ways that maybe no other UK leader has demonstrated. I hope that whoever moves forward, whoever the Tories select, and whoever the people of the United Kingdom select as their next prime minister understands that Ukraine matters to the people of the United Kingdom.
Yeah, Mr. Secretary, in the last 2016 Republican primary, I would ask every would-be Republican nominee about the triad and what was the most important part. In Great Britain, they've decided they need to update their nuclear boomers, their submarines that carry nuclear weapons. Do you think that has to be done? I mean, do you expect the conservatives will stand by that? Because they've been cutting their defense budget, even though they talk a good game.
It's not about talk, Hugh. This is a point that I was trying to make just a bit ago. It's about what do you actually deliver for the security of your own people. And for the United Kingdom, updating that fleet, the Boomer fleet, their nuclear submarine fleet, is essential. They've allowed their capacity there to deteriorate over the last, 25 years. It is time. No shortcuts, no interim steps. Deliver on that. It is a long run to get there. The Australians the same way. Each of us needs to make sure that our nuclear capabilities, and for the United States, by the way, we've got a ground-based system that the Democrats are talking about getting rid of that will matter a lot to the American people in the decade ahead. We have to continue to invest in those resources that will continue the nuclear deterrence that has served us all so well. For the United Kingdom, that means their subfleet.
Now, Mr. Secretary, staying on that, the Russian losses were reported over the weekend to have reached 25,000 KIA, not casualties, which normally conflates killed and wounded together, but killed in action, 25,000. That is such a stunning number for a 5-month engagement. That can Vladimir Putin keep that up?
Sadly, politically, I think he can. Query whether the military will be able to continue to deliver fresh people to the front lines in a way that will actually continue to push the fight. But this really gets to the core point. I've seen that number, 25,000 killed in action. I've seen casualty numbers, which includes wounded, that are triple that. Obviously, a closely kept secret. But it's big numbers. Query whether the West will continue to have the resolve to inflict those kinds of costs on the Russian military that will ultimately lead to Vladimir Putin turning tail. I hear talk from some former American leaders and current American leaders that say we have to have an off-ramp for this. The only way to deliver that outcome, the only way to get to what everybody wants, we want this conflict to end. The only way to get to that conflict to end, to actually be done, not for tomorrow and next week, not a stand down, not a temporary ceasefire. The only way to get Vladimir Putin to fundamentally give up his quest is deterrence. And that means imposing real costs and creating the perception in his head that the costs will exceed the benefits. We're not remotely close to that. And the loss of 25,000 Russian military lives is not sufficient to convince Vladimir Putin that this endeavor doesn't continue to be worthy.
Mr. Secretary, last night I was out to dinner with my brother-in-law, a former Marine artillery officer, and I mispronounced the name of the HIRAM system or HIRAM or whatever it is, but they're very effective. They blew up all of the ammo that Russia had gotten into the Donbass, warehouse after warehouse, so that there is a famine of ammo, according to some of the British reports on what happened. Why did it take us so long to get them that particular system and ought we to send them more, the Ukrainians, I mean?
Yes, we should quadruple down into that. And can I add unarmed aerial vehicles with precision-guided capabilities to provide the intelligence for precision targeting that is just as was described? We should be flooding the zone with that, not just us. The Europeans have these capabilities as well. We should be making sure that the Ukrainians have the capacity to use this precision targeting and precision intelligence in ways that will actually go after the strategic targets that you're describing. I don't know why we waited so long. It sounded like President Biden continued to shout escalation every time someone would offer up a high-end capability. The Ukrainians haven't asked for a single American soldier. They've just asked for the tools to wage war against an aggressor. We should have provided them months ago. We should provide them now, and not just three or four or five, but the dozens that they need to actually deliver something that feels like defeat for Vladimir Putin, which will cause him to fundamentally change the way he thinks about aggression in Europe. This isn't over, Hugh. The American people and people around the world sometimes think, gosh, it's just not on CNN every hour. Vladimir Putin's intentions have not yet changed, and the world's requirement is to make sure that we provide Ukraine the tools they need to change Vladimir Putin's perception of risk.
Last question, Mr. Secretary. I know you've been on the road with CavPAC.com supporting Republicans across the United States. The midterms are 4 months away. When you do that, when you go out and you talk for Adam Laxalt in Nevada, or you go stand with Herschel Walker in Georgia, or you'll be up there with Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania, wherever you go, you get a huge crowd. Does anyone care about the national security, or is it all just gas and food prices? Because I know the latter are driving daily kitchen table conversations, but we have to keep the country safe, and this administration is not doing that. Does that come up in your appearances?
Yeah, they're so deeply connected, Hugh. It absolutely comes up. Folks understand that when we lose what we had for 4 years, American energy dominance, the ability to deliver affordable energy to ourselves, that has national security implications and implications for the ability to afford to drive your kids to their soccer game or to their ballet recital. No, the American people get it. They understand the place. They understand the Chinese Communist Party isn't just a foreign problem, that they're inside the gates here, right, showing up at PT meetings and school board meetings and infiltrating our university systems. Those are things that impact their lives every day too. And sometimes we talk about them as if these are these two separate things, right? Foreign policy and the ability to feed your family and pay your rent and afford the energy for your car. They are deeply connected. The American people get it, and they know that President Biden has not delivered on either front.
Former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, my best to you. Thank you for joining me on the anniversary show.
Happy anniversary to you. So long, my friend.
Thank you. You know, it's always great when you get headliners like Mike Pompeo. CavPAC.com, America. CavPAC.com. If you want to support him traveling around the country and supporting candidates who are serious about national security and about Reaganite approaches to the economy, go to CavPAC.com. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned. I appreciate so much Kurt Schlichter sitting in for me on Thursday and Friday, and Ed Morrissey on Wednesday, as I managed to combine in one five-day sprint the 40th wedding anniversary of fetching Mrs. Hewitt agreeing to marry me at the Ranch House Chapel on Camp Pendleton, July 10, 1982. The 22nd anniversary of the Hugh Hewitt Show, which you've been hearing here for 22 years, with Dwayne here from day one and Adam from day eight. Jacob's got at least 8 weeks in, so that to go to that. And, of course, the high school reunion. The reunion of buddies and friends in the gang in Ohio. So I was in the land on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt celebrating this weekend. 40 years of marriage. That's a lot of marriage. And, of course, she is the hero of that story, and she is remarkable. We had a wonderful day yesterday up in the far reaches, hiking in the state park. I went to Mass. We went to church together. Up here, we do not have a Presbyterian church. We have a United Church of Christ. So you go from maybe the most conservative denomination, high Catholicism, I call it, to the UCC, which is the most liberal. So I got it all covered. Good hike, beautiful day in the state of Maine yesterday. And then a wonderful dinner at a great restaurant with my brother-in-law and his spouse, who are wonderful in-laws, and followed by a show down at Bowdoin College at the Maine State Music Summerfest. Symphony orchestra, great singers, doing basically classic rock from the 80s, but that's a little bit after my peak rock years in the Fetching Mystery. We had a wonderful day, though. Wonderful, wonderful 40th anniversary. And 22 years of this show, if you've been listening, that's 5,000 shows. All right, so you do about 250 shows a year after you subtract weekends and I worked a few weekends. And after you take out the holidays, and Salem syndicates have about 12 or 13 a year, and then you take out 20 days off, and you multiply that by 12 segments, actually 12 and a half segments, because the show used to have 15 segments a day, now got 12. But in any event, it's more than 63,000 segments of radio in 22 years. We are now into year 23, and that means about 30,000 interviews, as I roughly do of my time in interview style and half talking to you. I must tell you, that's a lot of interviews, and the archive will be updated and put over at hughhewitt.com. If you join the universe, and you should, you can get every one of those interviews for 22 years. And there are very memorable ones with many former presidents, prime ministers, Oscar winners, authors, you name it, we do it. Today, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is joining us. Jake Sherman, of course, from Punchbowl News as Congress returns today. Selena Zito, who sat down with Henry Kissinger recently. Noah Rothman will be along, the author of The Rise of the New Puritans. There's a lot ahead today, but mostly my thanks to Mrs. H., the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. 40 years she's put up with his nonsense. Can you imagine being married to a journalist for 40 years? Now, I know there are some out there who have gone the distance and stuck. I've read their memoirs, people like Tom Brokaw and people like Katie Couric, who lost her first husband and is wonderful with her second. And there are lots of great, great journalists who have gone 20 and 30. But the number have gone 40 years. And I have I was in the government for the first eight. I didn't actually start holding forth on radio until 1990. And radio and television began in 1992. And writing began earlier. She puts up with an awful lot of weird schedule stuff. Like today, I've got to go back to the Beltway today. I'm interviewing Governor Glenn Youngkin and First Lady Youngkin tomorrow in front of a group of younger center-right people, influencers, they call it. And then I will be with Brett Baer on Wednesday night. So I've just got one of those weeks, and she just smiles and drives me to the airport because she's wonderful. And Dwayne and Adam, they don't smile much, but they're still here. I mean, out of those 5,000 shows, Dwayne's made at least half of them. Adam's been there all 5,000, but I think Dwayne's been at least half of them, maybe a third. Generalissimo, have you made a third of these, do you think?
You may have done 5,000 shows, but Adam and I have done about six.
Because you're always there when I'm not. You're right. You ought to be listening to Dwayne. The other show that has gone on that many episodes, I don't know if the after show has done that many episodes. Has it, Generalissimo?
It has not done that many. I think I started doing that around 2008-ish, somewhere in there.
Do the math. And you don't have segments. You just have a monologue.
Pretty much. I just do a podcast, right?
But that is all available for you at the universe, but you must pay to join that. And Adam, young man, we took a chance on you a week into the show. After the only other engineer we ever had, Matt Cunningham, almost took us off the air. And you haven't quit yet, have you, Adam?
No, not a good time to quit a job.
Okay, good. Well, hey, you can't quit. He's actually manacled to the board. He can't, because every time I need to call for, you know, one of the memorable sound bites, for example, Dwayne seeing the spider. Can we get that one, Adam, for the anniversary show? Dwayne seeing the spider? Because Dwayne was... I got Dwayne to watch a video once telling him it was an important news
item. Yeah, because that was the peak of 22 years.
That was the peak of 22 years. People say, what was the highlight of your 22 years on air? It's Dwayne watching the YouTube video. There's a spider crawling up the wall.
Oh, it could be the black cow, brown cow moment. It could be.
Oh, I bring that up too. Black cow, brown cow.
It could be the 50 laps on It's a Small World. It could be any number of shows that we've done. The ice house fishing in Minnesota.
Yep, definitely up there.
Any of these shows we could have done, but no.
All the Republican conventions, former President Trump, always the best interview in America, whether he's slapping me around or not.
Yep.
And
Minnesota State Fair.
Minnesota State. You just name it. We've done it. We've now done it from France. We are now international. And Dwayne in the Beret would certainly be that. But we are grateful that you listen every single day. Let me get to the news. Congress is back. They are juggling a China bill, Democrats' climate and drug pricing ambitions, according to the Wall Street Journal. Mitch McConnell said, if you do the latter, your drug pricing, your climate control, your taxes and your spending, and a reconciliation bill, which they're attempting to resurrect the remnants of Build Back Better in an inflationary moment and spend more millions and billions and trillions of dollars. It would be actually trillions. In the middle of a stagflation, in the middle of a recession that's beginning, I'm not buying any other bills. The New York Times this weekend figuring out that at 79, headline, at 79, Biden is testing the boundaries of age in the presidency. Do you think BA5 variant spreading? And it is. Basically, everybody I know have had it. Now, I've been traveling on airplanes and airports where nobody's masked. Anymore. I mean, a few people are masked. But, you know, if you're going to get it, I hope you've had your vaccinations and your boosters, because like Chuck Schumer, who got it yesterday, you'll be fine if you had. The Omicron subvariants are pushing up hospitalization in Europe and the U.S., but not deaths, because we've got the number on this and people have got better remedies. The Washington Post is out sounding the alarm about the GOP having are worrying about their Senate chances. Actually, they're not. I think Herschel's going to win. And they're writing about Herschel Walker and the fact that Herschel's team put out all the Oppo research on him early, so that it would not matter, so that the Democrats couldn't dump it on him in the last 30 days of the election. So that's fine. He's just going through his ringer right now, and Herschel's going to win. And Dr. Oz is going to win in Pennsylvania. J.D. Vance, they're trying. I was just in Ohio, my friends. And there, I'll talk about this with Noah Rothman later. There are Trump signs everywhere. And that is sort of the center of the world for Trumpdom. Elon Musk responds by laughing at Twitter, as he's broken the Twitter deal. Ron DeSantis is blasting the fake civics bill, the Civics Secures Democracy Act. Glenn Youngkin announced his education board picks, and they're all very, very mainstream, but they are going to bring, I think parents are the hidden dynamite in the election that comes up before us. Japan's ruling party, after the terrible assassination of former Prime Minister Abe, swept to a huge victory yesterday, and they will be amending the Constitution so that they can deal quite effectively with the rise of China. They are going to revise Japan's Constitution. They needed three quarters of the upper house to do that. They've got three quarters of the lower house. They are going to get that, and Japan is going to be ready for the coming conflict with China, which is already underway. And after the break, I will cover in depth the resignation announcement of Boris Johnson. And this matters, America. I will be covering who will be the next prime minister of Great Britain very, very closely, because it matters a lot to the United States and its future and to the next 22 years of the Hugh Hewitt Show. I said to the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt yesterday, if we do another 40, we're both going to be 106, which given medical science isn't really impossible. I don't know if you can put up with me for another 40. And she said, not if you're on the radio. So I only think I can go 39 more years on the radio. Stay tuned, America. I am Hugh Hewitt from Studio Winterfell. Look tonight. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. It's the anniversary show. 22 years done, the 23rd year of the show begun, and my 40th wedding anniversary yesterday. And I wanted to do an in-depth author interview on my anniversary show, because that's one of the things I'm known for on radio, is actually reading the books. Noah Rothman has written a fabulous new book, The Rise of the New Puritans, Fighting Back Against the Progressives' War on Fun. And The Rise of the New Puritans is in bookstore everywhere. You can get it at Amazon. Noah joins me now. Good morning, Noah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thanks for having me here.
You know, I had to read this en route to Cleveland via Pittsburgh and LaGuardia. So I sat next to lefties on both planes, and they're looking at the cover thinking The Rise of the New Progressives, the War on Fun, and I'm getting funny looks. I think at the end of this, I believe that the country is now at peak woke. Do you agree?
It very well could be. We might be on the downswing. You never know when you're in the middle of it, right? But you do see signs that there's a backlash building, that there's frustration among people who are Democrat. I mean, the people I spoke with, 9 out of 10 of them, liberal, identify as Democrat, vote Democrat, wouldn't vote Republican if you put a gun to their head. But they resent the conditions that are sapping them of enthusiasm for their life's work. They don't get to do the way this book is all about cultural products. If you produce a cultural product, you don't get to focus on your work anymore, not exclusively. You have to focus on the political conditions around you.
Here's the good news. The progressive woke left does not read influential books from the center right. They don't read Guy Benson. They don't read you. They don't read Mary Catherine Hamm. So they do not know how bad you gigged them. You gigged them like the emperor gigged Russell Crowe at the end of Gladiator. They do not know they're bleeding out in the pages of the Rise of the New Puritans, do they? Or have they figured it out and have they come for you?
I've gotten a little bit of flack suggesting I'm over the target. But like you say, you know, there is a lot of resistance among people who are predisposed towards this movement, progressive Puritanism, or are cowed and intimidated by it. So, yeah, I sense we're breaking through a little bit, but there's more work to be done.
I am in awe of the work that you put into this, Noah, because you had to dive deep into the woke left. And that comes, I've decided, based upon references, the woke left lives at Vox. They live at the editorial pages of the New York Times, and they are overwhelmingly populated by law professors. If I actually did a count, I would bet that you are the author who has quoted more law professors than any other author in America in the course of actually reading their work. And most of them, as I know, I've been teaching con law since 1996. Most of them are pretty far down the rabbit hole of the left.
Sure. Well, I mean, the focus of this book attempts to be that which should be outside the political arena. Politics has infected things that don't respond to politics, don't respond to legislative remedies. We've imposed political themes on things like sports, fashion, culture, your entertainment products, the family, and the food you eat, the comedy you enjoy. All this stuff should exist outside of politics. It has been subsumed into a political milieu that doesn't serve it well, that saps it of the enjoyment that you otherwise would have. And, you know, because if you dive down into the historical strains here, which I attempted to do, I attempt to try to decode this puzzle. You know, you've been staring at this puzzle. Why has this happened? Why all of a sudden have the tendencies that we've sort of attributed to the right, this priggishness, prudishness, and an idea that innocent cultural fare can corrupt you and degrade society? That was a tendency we used to attribute to the right. The left, by contrast, emphasize self-gratification, self-fulfillment, hedonism, even at the expense of self-destruction. That has changed over the course of maybe a decade, rapidly in the space of cultural evolution. And why? The why of it makes sense when you begin to dive into the intellectual strains of progressivism. As the left identifies more with progressivism and less with liberalism, classical or otherwise, they've adopted its habits of mind, among them utopianism, a hatred of idleness, a fear of idleness. That which is idle, which does not contribute to the progressive project, is worse than worthless. It's actively detrimental to the progressive project. And if you pull on that thread, you get to 19th century progressivism. And you pull a little bit more, you get to 16th century, 17th century Puritanism, the strains of mainline Protestantism that evolved into what we understand to be nascent progressivism. So it's sort of a decoder ring to help you understand why we got to this lamentable place and a set of prescriptions on how to get out.
You spent, I'm going to go to the end now, and I'm going to give away the end. Everything comes full circle. Noah begins with the Puritan settlement of Massachusetts, and he ends with Increase Mather, my favorite name among the Puritans. Increase Mather lived, and I did not know how long he lived, 84 years. He spanned the 17th and the 18th century. Increase Mather ended, as you recount in Rise of the New Puritans, depressed. Upset that the project had failed, and it failed because not only Charles the First, but generally American mercantilism was incompatible with puritanical zeal, and it had to give way among many of the same forces which I see, Noah, and I want to know if you're an optimist. I'm very optimistic that we are at peak woke. It falls apart now because you cannot maintain a market for that which people do not want, whether it's ESPN or the NFL, or any of the other things we talk about in here, it just will not work. And Increase Mather rued that, and I think there will be in 50 years, you might be updating this in 50 years if you're long-lived, because this is the first shot warning them they have gone too far and the market will rebel.
Right. So one of the things that you probably think of when you think of a stereotypical Puritan, first of all, scholars of Puritans really don't like it when we lean into our stereotypes of Puritanism, which are mostly formed in the 19th century and the Victorianism and the Comstockery into which it evolved. Puritans themselves get a pretty bad rap. But yes, Increase Mather lived to see what he understood to be the death of his experiment He was rather bitter, not only towards his environment, but his fellow Puritans, that they have failed to live up to his vision. But, the witch trials is one of those things that you think about as a stereotype. And that really is the final throw of what had otherwise been a terminal illness that had been building over the course of 30 years. As the covenant that Puritans had established between the church and the state, there was no distinction between the two. But the crown, through its interventions and over the course of a series of moral crises after King Philip's war, dissolved this covenant, and Puritans had to make a series of compromises with that. And that breakdown of this environment that they understood, that they knew how to navigate, created the conditions for inchoate moral panics. And then you look around you and you see this dissolving covenant, inchoate moral panics, and it all starts to make a fair amount of sense to a degree that I thought was rather shocking. The parallels are very striking. But it also begins with this understanding that what they are trying to achieve here is it cannot be achieved, this kind of homogenized monoculture in which the totalitarian Puritan vision thrived. Now, totalitarian, by which I don't mean authoritarian, they were radically democratic. But they also imposed on their fellow congregants and their fellow citizens a way of life, a modus vivendi, which is what I think we're witnessing here. It mimics a secular faith, but it is not a faith. It is a theory of social organization that has no room for and cannot tolerate dissent.
I want to tell people that in the rise of the new Puritans, and by the way, Noah, Frank Luntz's rule is if you do not say the title of the book seven times in any interview, you're not doing your job. So I've got four in, but you have to start mentioning the rise of the new Puritan,
The rise of the new Puritans, fighting back against war on fun. You're not the first to tell me this.
I know, you've got to repeat the rise of the new Puritan seven times in every segment or it won't sell. And right now it's at 2,000 on Amazon and skyrocketing up. I want to thank you for introducing me to, your scholarship is pretty good here. No, I've done a lot of reading on early American, Judith Sklar taught me early American political thought, but I had never come across the tithing man before. And the tithing man was the Puritan zeal to patrol, of all things, the family. In many of the same ways, I found it very provocative that you identify peak woke as opposed to, the progressive as opposed to, the family as we understood it even 50 years ago. The family is no longer your family. It's the movement's family.
Right. Well, in the Puritans' time, the family was the primary economic unit of society. And it could not be, you could not trust it to police itself. You could not trust it to structure itself because it was so pivotal to the central animating thesis of Puritanism, making this whole experiment work. And that was the constabulary that enforced this were tithing men who visited homes, ensured that children were being properly disciplined. Now, that's the sort of thing that you would think if you steep yourself in the sort of the liberalism that we grew up with, that we understood through all our adult lives, which was very permissive when it came to parenting, de-emphasized discipline, emphasized affection, emphasized learning through experimentation. It was called progressive parenting. It has fallen out of favor along with this idea that you can be trusted to organize and structure your own family. We have been offloading a lot of these responsibilities to the state to a degree that I think encourages abuses. We talk about very, very overactive courts, a conspiracy of very overactive courts, child protective services departments, and families who are invested in policing other families in ways that are verge on paranoid to a degree that has resulted in abuses. Families, there's something like 20,000 kids a year are now removed from their caretakers, their parents, for the space of 24 hours and simply returned right back to them because nothing had occurred except the fact that the state was a little concerned that you weren't parenting properly.
Part of the constabulary is actually NPR. Now, I love NPR. I worked for PBS for 10 years on TV. And you work for part of the constabulary, as I used to, MSNBC. And CNN is part of the constabulary. I never ask people to rag on the people with whom they work because I don't do it. You don't do it. There are only two kinds of center right people on legacy media, and they are either missionaries or refugees. You're a missionary. I was a missionary. Refugees are a different category. So you're a missionary. You're doing good work. But Madison University's Travis Ryder says to NPR, here's a provocative thought. Maybe we should protect our kids by not having them. That's not provocative. No, that's stupid. And there's a lot of self-evidently stupid things that the zeal, the momentum inevitably carries a woke progressive, not only across the goal line, but out of the end zone and sometimes out of the stadium. They don't have any breaks.
There's an existential dread that is being imposed on people who otherwise wouldn't have it. There's a moral black, a campaign of moral blackmail underway here that wouldn't be objectionable if this was a matter of choice, frankly. Now, I have kids. I find a measure of satisfaction in family, as I suppose a lot of your audience does. Not everybody does. And if it was a personal choice to eschew creating a family, then that's one matter. But what we're seeing here and what I quote a lot of these people who are receptive to this message is that they desperately want a family. They want the satisfaction found in parenthood. They're afraid for it. They're afraid that they're consigning their children to a horrible future in which the living will envy the dead. And it is truly bizarre and, frankly, in an effort to immiserate the people around you, perhaps so that they will share your misery. It is an unsustainable condition in the absence of a coercive mechanism. And that coercive mechanism in this case is imposing on them existential dread because of their conditions, climate change, rising income inequality, the sort of stuff that we could otherwise navigate, pretty effectively, and you will still manage to find a measure of happiness.
The endless virus. I'm going to come back with Noah Rothman. We're going to continue our conversation about his brand new book, The New Puritans, The Rise of the New Puritans. It is over at Amazon.com. If you follow my Twitter feed, you can go and link it and order it right now. And you will, it will not only entertain you, but it will inform you. The bell curve is always the bell curve, and the woke is our all. There's a bell curve among the woke, and there are some really crazy ones. Noah's read them all. I'll be right back with more of him on The Rise of the New Puritans. Stay tuned.
Tonight.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. It is the 23rd year, the 22nd anniversary of the Hugh Hewitt Show. More importantly, the 40th anniversary of my marriage was yesterday, and we always celebrate by playing the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt's favorite song. I am joined in this anniversary show by Noah Rothman, a friend of a few years' acquaintance. Now, he writes often a commentary. I used to be on Morning Joe with him when I worked at NBC and MSNBC. Noah is the author of a brand spanking, fabulous new book, The Rise of the New Puritans, which I spent the last 3 days in airports reading. And I want to say, Noah, the mark of a good book of the center right. I don't often read in the center right because I don't learn anything. I've been doing this so long. But I learned a lot from you. I learned a couple of things that I did not know I want the audience to know. I did not realize that comedy is in a death spiral at the box office. That I've been the subject of attack by a lot of Hollywood people over the years. Seth Rogen among them, David Price, David Simon, I mean, the guy who did The Wire. I do care that they're killing off comedy, that woke has made the joke a thing of the past, at least at the box office. Would you unravel for people what has happened to comedy releases on the big screen as a result of the new Puritanism?
Yeah, big screen, feature-length motion pictures, comedic screenplays are on the decline rapidly. You could say the same, actually, for effective sex sequences. In fact, this is something that film critics have been noting and lamenting, although they have also created this very same conditions that have brought about the thing they're lamenting, their despair. Comedy is declining, and you talk about people who pitch these scripts, like Will Ferrell is quoted in this script as saying, it's just touchy. It's touchy out there. There's sensitivity to the joke. And in my comedy chapter, the chapter that talks about comedy, it discusses the ways in which cultural arbiters who determine what is appropriate for audiences these days do a great disservice to a lot of the comics, particularly anti-comics, who play around with themes that aren't especially funny. And there's room to be a monologist. The Spalding Grays of the world have their audiences. But what enlivens them, and I pick on Hannah Gadsby in particular, who's an Australian anti-comic, who is funny when she wants to be.
And anti-comic is the best term. Would you explain for the benefit of the audience who've never heard of her, and there will be some, who she is and why she is an anti-comic who's funny? Occasionally.
Comedian?
Yeah.
Okay. When she wants to be. She'll make a punchline and make you laugh, but she will also build the same tension that would lead to a laugh and not allow the release of a punchline. She'll circle back to the joke she told 5 minutes ago and make you interrogate yourself and say, why did you think that was funny? Was my pain really all that important that you should laugh at it? And that's the stuff that enlivens her audience. They get a profound thrill from the pain, quote, the assault, the interrogation that you experience. This is not a joke per se, because you're not supposed to laugh. I mean, that's really the emphasis of a joke. On the one side, they're emphasizing the pain that someone experienced so that you could have a punchline. On the other side, They're going after what they call right-wing comedy. There's a gentleman whose essay I pick apart in this piece, Seth Simons, who identifies the establishment of the alt-right in a form of comedy that was really common in the early 2000s, colloquially called cringe, which leverages horrible things for laughter: racism, sexism, homophobia, assault, the sort of thing that you would – that clinical description of dark humor would make you think, well, these people must be terrible. If you like that joke, much less tell it, you must be a bad person. But this is the essence of dark humor, of gallows humor, the ability to plumb the depths of human despair to make it endurable, to laugh your way up the gallows steps. And he identifies in this alt-right inception, the genesis of the alt-right in comedy, and drags it all the way to January 6th. This is why we had the January 6th riots, this black swan event, which has somehow happened as a result of this pretty mundane phenomenon, dark humor. And these two conditions are at work to try to destroy comedy, to make sure that you don't have the joy of a laugh, the release of a laugh, because that's a trite pleasure. It's a frivolous pleasure, and it does not advance the the puritanical progressive project, which compels you as a duty, as a responsible human being, to dwell on the world's horrors at all times and in all things. Even your desire for escapism is sort of a moral failing on your part. If you really are to make a better world and commit to this moral obligation that you have to do this labor, to work in the pursuit of a better world, then you can't allow yourself an escape. There is no escape.
And Noah Rothman, perhaps the most shocking revelation to me is that race essentialism in the course of the rise of the New Puritans, which you've got to say seven times or people won't know to go and buy it, is that race essentialism has entered into baseball card collecting. Now, I have a brother-in-law who grew up on a farm, and that means going to school on a bus, coming back and working morning, noon, and night. He has a baseball card collection, which is magnificent and massive, and it's in pristine condition. And I did not realize it was an agent of racism. And would you explain how race essentialism, it's not just Colin Kaepernick kneeling, it's not just the NFL losing its market share or ESPN becoming unwatchable, it's baseball card collecting.
Yeah, there was an early 2000 study aptly titled Racism Everywhere, which identified in the values of baseball cards a sort of racist impulse that resulted in lower values for players of color that was otherwise not the case experienced by white players. Now, that study has since been debunked, or at least a more accurate reflection of why these values are what they are has taken over in the academic community, but this still maintains its hold over the progressive imagination. Race essentialism finds its way into what actors are allowed to play certain roles, what clothing you're allowed to wear. It's a sort of puritanical sumptuary law, but the accidents of birth that your garb is supposed to reflect is not economic so much as ethnic. This is a uniform you're expected to wear to navigate society. And in that baseball card piece, it appears in the chapter on hobbies called Fear of God, which finds in seemingly banal activities, home decorating, fly fishing, gardening, jogging, video game playing, half a dozen other otherwise innocuous activities, the sort of lurking, seedy underbelly that informs it as long – and you can see it as long as you have this decoder ring. If you're initiated into this point of view – one of my scholars, who I quote in this, attributes it to a very puritanical tendency, which he called anxious introspection, which is the belief that sin exists in you in latent form, in vestigial form, and that it has the capacity to erupt and corrupt your environment in ways that are unknowable except to those who are most properly educated in this particular point of view, which is why it has become a pastime in its own way to identify the seedy racist workings behind the curtain that render things like sewing and knitting to be activities that are that have a racist element to them, unless you are properly attuned to the temptations lurking just beneath the surface of your otherwise placid, banal activities.
So Noah, I want to propose to you what I took away from this is my next step theory. First of all, wokeism has introduced a two-track mind. We've got to be playing the track of will this offend and ignite a mob at the same time that we are commenting. So you have to do your media hits and I have to do 3 hours of radio a day for 23 years, aware that the mob is ready on Twitter and everywhere to come for you. And you have to either be prepared to take the heat or not. But everyone, not just in comedy, that's what I extrapolated out of the chapter on comedy, but in every pastime in public or that which might be recorded, you must always be on guard because you will set them off. But I also, it will devour itself. And like the radical right, and this is what I want to put, that there is an essential parallelism between the progressive new Puritans and the radical alt-right, in that they are intolerant of everything and unwilling to even attribute a shred of good faith to everyone. Now, on the first part, what I did not, I think your book went to press before Will Smith slapped Chris Rock. And in that delayed reaction of the audience, where they first approved, then they didn't approve, then they booed, and then the Academy revoked, all that was an accelerated new Puritanism trying to process an event that many people saw. It's exhausting. We can't do that every day. That's why it's doomed. That's what I took away from the rise of the new Puritanism, is that woke is doomed. Have many other people come to the same conclusion?
Not in the way that you've expressed it. No, I mean, what you described there is an intellectual reaction that overtakes what was otherwise an instinctual response.
Yes.
The instinctual response is horror.
Yep.
The intellectual reaction there is to say, well, maybe we can contextualize this in a way that
yes.
would not offend our co-religionists here. The instinctual response is one of the primary themes of this book because it is so despised. The instinctual gut laugh that erupts from your belly after a ribald joke, an offensive joke. You know, the Epicurean sigh that you release after this really sinfully decadent meal. I mean,
that man's kneeling during the national anthem. My instinctual response is that's not patriotic. But then we've been contextualizing Colin Kaepernick and everybody else for years. It's exhausting.
Sure. So if there's an end to this that I can identify from the past, I think it is encapsulated in the phrase banned in Boston. So in the 19th century
chapter,
Comstockery at its height, you know, the mainline Protestantism, which is the nucleus where progressivism emerged, had organized itself around a campaign to fight one of the most insidious evils imaginable, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. And it was profoundly successful. They got it. It was not published in Boston because of this movement. Plays were bodlerized. Songs were not allowed to be played on the radio. Dime store novels, popular everywhere in the country. You couldn't get them. They're behind locked doors in this part of the world. And this was an esoteric feature of the Boston scene, and indeed a warning against impure, licentious literature, until it wasn't. Until a certain point at which a backlash formed and a young reactionary set rejected this. And this banned in Boston label went from being a warning against impure literature to a powerful advertisement for it. Publishers actively sought to have their books banned in Boston to increase sales nationally. The modern equivalent, I submit, is banned on Facebook. Banned on Amazon, where conservative authors, and it's primarily conservative authors who find themselves running afoul of young, ill-equipped censors, see their books explode in popularity in ways that are not justified by the PR campaign around them, by what their publishers have put into these books. They find themselves being advertised and their themes advertised and finding real commercial success as a result of this censorious reaction against them. So
Josh Hawley. Came out with Regnery, which is owned by Salem. I want to disclose that. And they made a lot of money off Josh Hawley's book, and it's a very good book. I had the senator on. Only after, I think it was Simon & Schuster, I don't want to slander someone wrongly, I think it was Simon & Schuster pulled the plug on Josh Hawley's book because they did not want Josh Hawley after the infamous photo, which is not contextualized. The woke never contextualize, but always insist on being contextualized. He sold a lot more books and made much more of an impact on big tech's future than had he just put out another senator's book on another subject that most people wouldn't read.
Right. Yeah, likely. I mean, no offense. I have not read the senator's book yet, but most likely a rather dry vehicle for a politician's national ambitions. You wouldn't usually become a national bestseller, especially one of many who's embarked on this course. It did so because of this wild reaction against it. Likewise, I cite a variety of authors, Abby Schreier's book. All of them find the Old Abe, which was this novel that was blurbed by Mike Pence that somehow was banned on Facebook just because it came out in 2020 and Mike Pence had looked at it askance. This sort of thing creates a backlash against it. And so I conclude rather sardonically that it's my fondest hope that somebody cancels this book, because everyone will win.
Yes, everyone wins. Now, let me wrap this up. And you've been very generous with your time, Noah. I did love the book, and I want everyone to go out and get The Rise of the New Puritans.
Thank you.
Do you think that we have, in fact, passed into the mockery state? Woke becomes a joke, and then it becomes broke. That's what happened with ESPN. First, people laugh at it up their sleeve, and then all of a sudden your audience is gone. Because if you lose your audience, you lose your income. If you lose your income, you lose your ability. The market, the invisible hand will crush woke. That's my conclusion. What's yours?
It's possible. I think so, but I don't think we're there yet. There's some growing pains yet to be had, and may get worse before it gets better. But the seeds of the backlash are rather plain and hard to ignore. So if my goal of this book, one, is to give you some sense of how this movement fits in with historical trends and maybe decodes a little bit of why this happens so fast and how it goes away. My second primary objective, I think, is for you to have a good time. I set out to write a book I wanted to read and wanted to write and to enjoy myself at a time when covering politics was a chore, a slog. The life that I had established for myself that I was enjoying up to a minute ago was no longer fun. I hope to and I'm not alone. I hope to channel that sentiment and give you some permission to laugh, to enjoy yourself, to live a carefree, joyous life, because you are setting an example that is far more easy to emulate and more rewarding to emulate than the trial that these people have imposed on themselves. It's sucking the fun out of their lives, and you don't have to do it. Nobody's making you do it.
And for the politically active, my audience is 70% homeowners with children. That's what we do, demographic analysis. And homeowners with children are living a difficult life. They don't want to be in trouble. They don't want to cross the line.
Right.
I'm here to tell them, if you read Noah's book, you will realize you're not alone. Most people don't like the new Puritanism. They want to break free of it. And I think a listener to this show, a reader of my columns, a consumer of things that I like, and I like the new Rise of the New Puritans a lot, they'll be relieved to know that other people have the same reaction they do to the excess of woke. And I think you're chronicling a moment at which the kimono goes full open and we see just how absurd it is.
I really hope so. I mean, it's hilarious.
Yes.
Honestly, like if this movement didn't have teeth to it, and it does, I understand that, you might feel like there's more risk and reward than living the joyful life that I espouse and mocking the people who engage in these great displays of self-sacrifice in pursuit of popularizing the idea that there's world historic import in your burrito. There isn't.
But
you don't
I have to ask
to
you one
this.
Hard question. Did you have to go back at the end and make sure that you included the necessary disclaimer? I know, because I know you think that the Me Too movement was justified in its origin and that some of its targets were absolutely correct to be brought down.
Sure.
You have to write that down. At the beginning of every chapter, you must make the disclosure that there is virtue in the original impulse. You do that repeatedly. Did you check yourself? Did someone check your homework to make sure you had done the appropriate contextualizing so that no one could say that Noah Rothman was not sensitive to the concerns of the legitimate Me Too movement?
I don't think so, because I did it initially, and I am. The chapters in this book are organized around unimpeachable moral virtues.
Yes.
Piety, prudence, temperance, austerity, the fear of God, and order. And the chapter on temperance that you're describing, which is on sex and booze, the progressive left has rediscovered a very old moral order that conservatives know to work. It is that when you don't have any boundaries for yourself and your loved ones, when social situations in which men and women are present, and that is bathed in booze, bad things can happen.
Again and again.
This is something that the progressive left is rediscovering, this moral precept that the right has known for a very long time. This is an effective way to establish social order. It is just, it's coming with a lot of growing pains, because this licentiousness that typified the progressive left of an earlier generation and no longer does is finding a very difficult equilibrium with this new, far more austere generation. But the hedonism that was the Hugh Hefner version, idea of how social societies should organize themselves, sows the seeds of its own destruction because of its failure to establish borders and boundaries for people. So I am sympathetic towards the theory that they're working towards. It's the means and the methods that have become so onerous and intolerant.
Perfectly balanced, wonderfully written, The Rise of the New Puritans in bookstores everywhere. Noah, continued success to you, and may the book tour go well. They're never fun, but you are doing your work. Just remember, keep saying The Rise of the New Puritans again and again and again. Noah, have a great day.
Thank you, Hugh. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.
This cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt on the anniversary show. 40 years married to the fetching Mrs. Hewitt. 22 years finished on the air. 23 years underway with Selena Zito. So happy she's my first guest in year 23. Hello, Selena. The Yinzer Report is about Dr. Kissinger. That's a surprise. When did you go see the great old man, as they used to call Gladstone?
Yeah, that was a surprise. I was thinking that 12-year-old Selena, if you would have told her, you know, in 1972 that she was going to interview Henry Kissinger, and I was obsessed with everything that was going on with the world, even at 12, I would have thought you were crazy. And yet, here I am interviewing Dr. Kissinger.
Now, I've had the honor of sitting down with him a few times in the last few years, and his new book, Leadership, is out. What did you talk about? Because Dr. K is still as sharp as anyone in the world. He moves at his own pace, right? He dictates the terms of the interview and the pace with which he moves. How did it go? Where did it go? And tell the audience generally what you took away from it.
Well, as you point out, he is incredibly sharp. He hasn't missed a step at all. That we're all that fortunate at 99 is would be wonderful. But he, you know, I was interested obviously in talking to him about his book, but also what he thought of today's leadership and what his concerns were about leadership going forward. And one of the things I think was, I asked him about what his thoughts were about Trump and Obama, because they were two incredibly very different men, approached foreign policy in a very different way. But he was counsel to both of them. And so I think that is one of the more interesting parts of the interview. But this is a man who has been, began his career in the White House in 1954 in the Eisenhower White House. I don't think people realize that. He was also in the Kennedy White House, and then, but the only president, I thought this was fascinating, since Eisenhower, who he has not either worked for or has sat with at the White House for counsel, is Joe Biden.
This is interesting. I mean, Joe Biden was elected to the Senate in 1972 when Dr. Kissinger was taking over the State Department as Nixon's second term got underway. And that the current president is not called the former Secretary of State, who was consulted by every Secretary of State of both parties and every president of both parties, tells you a little bit about the castle, the man in the castle. Joe Biden doesn't want advice, even from people who are older and wiser than he is. And there are a lot of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was incredibly telling. And Kissinger goes on to talk about in the interview, and I thought this was fascinating. He essentially says that there is a deep concern that there are great leaders out there that we will never know about because the current conditions in our society, meaning the onslaught of cable news, the onslaught of social media, and the impact that has on a person's decision as to whether they will rise up or not. He is deeply concerned that that's going to happen, that there's someone out there already that would be an incredible leader that we will never know about because of this situation that we have created.
Now, I got to ask you, Selena, when in the day, Henry Kissinger cut a swath through social Washington. And if we had a a equivalent miniseries to The Crown, you'd have to go with Kissinger, because part of the fun of The Crown is she goes through all these prime ministers, like 25 of them from the time she assumed the kingship in the early 50s. And Dr. K has gone through presidents and secretary of state and dates. I mean, he had this. Isn't that amazing that he was the dashing figure of D.C. in the 70s?
Oh, I remember, you know, when you're 12, 13, 14 years old, you see the opposite sex as, you know, the person that you would want would be like very like Prince Charming looking if you're a girl. Right. And I remember seeing all these photos of him with these glamorous, gorgeous women. And I was like, oh, I get it. And then I get it. Like, you know, it wasn't about the looks. It's about the intellect. It's about the seat of the table in power. It's about the conversation and the wit.
My sister-in-law was in the Foreign Service at the time and recalls that at a Finnish event, they were stationed in Helsinki. They couldn't understand why no one was leaving because the ambassadors had left. And sure enough, Dr. K showed up and all the Finnish women wanted to be photographed with Dr. Kissinger. It's just a funny thing that people won't know unless they were paying attention at the time as teenagers.
Yes,
hard to believe.
Absolutely. And I was.
Great, great column, Selena Zito, in the New York Post. All of her columns in the Pittsburgh Press, in the New York Post, in the Washington Examiner. Everything that Selena writes is available at selenazito.com. Go get it. Come back. Jake Sherman is next as the anniversary show. 23 years underway here on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Stay with us. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live from Studio Winterfell up in the great state of Maine. Headed to the Beltway after the program today. It's my anniversary show. 40 years married to the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt yesterday. 22 years done. And year 23 begun on the Hugh Hewitt Show. And I am so pleased that on this anniversary show, Jake Sherman joins me from PunchbowlNews.com. Jake may not have been born when the show started. Certainly wasn't born when Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I got married at Camp Pendleton 40 years ago. But every morning I read his Punchbowl News because, and you should too, PunchbowlNews.com, because now I know Bernie Sanders broke his hip. Honestly, Jake, I had not seen that. I hope the senator is doing well, but of course.
That's Pat Leahy.
Pat Leahy, not Chuck. Chuck Schumer has COVID. Pat Leahy broke his hip. I would not have known that about Senator Leahy if you had not written it up. I mean, how are they going to run the Senate with Schumer with COVID and Leahy? And I hope they're both recovering, but that's kind of hard with a 50-50 Senate.
It is at the moment, and happy anniversary.
Thank you.
To your marriage and to your show.
Thank you.
So, it's going to be a difficult week. I don't, you know, listen, they have the Dettelbach nomination at ATF, which I think will get through. They'll need Vice President Kamala Harris to get it through. But the larger problem is, we like to say politics is a contact sport. And with Schumer on the sidelines and an incredibly aggressive agenda over the next 3 weeks, that could set people back. That could set the Democrats back. So, it is a little bit of a problem as we head into the first week in session in 2 weeks.
You know, Jake, I want to remind the audience who's old enough, if they need Pat Leahy, they will do what was done with Pete Wilson, who had emergency appendicitis, appendix surgery when he was, I think it was his appendix blew, when he was a senator, and they needed his vote. So they wheeled the former senator, former governor, and the man who introduced the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt to me 42 years ago. They wheeled him onto the Senate. So if they need Leahy, they'll get him there, don't you think?
Yeah, and he said he would be available for four votes this week if he's needed. But that said, I don't believe he'll be needed this week. But it does, again, and we're constantly reminded of this, it does show the fragility of the Democratic majority. You know, at a 50-50 split, it's incredibly, incredibly, incredibly difficult to legislate.
Now, Jake, you report on this. And by the way, did you see the statistics over the weekend on the decline, precipitous, in trust in journalism, both print and broadcast? It's incredible. It's fallen off the cliff. I think Punchbowl News keeps people's objective credibility because you're objective. You note that Senator Kyrsten Sinema has said nothing about the attempt to resurrect Build Back Better in a sort of one-third of Build Back Better size. If, I don't think it's going to get out of committee because I don't think anyone has the heart to spend a bunch of money on electric cars right now.
Well, a few things. I don't think it'll go through committee, number one. Number two, if there's two different dynamics here. There's the, will it, right now, I mean, a provision to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices is incredibly popular. That could get through. But then do you start adding tax increases into it? As you note, the electric vehicle and some of the climate stuff is on the table. Who knows if it's actually going to get done? And then it just becomes very difficult. Here's what I think, Hugh. I think if it gets to the House of Representatives, I think if it includes tax increases, it's going to be really difficult to get through. I just think that's the reality of it. You have a lot of Democrats who are going to be very skeptical.
Jake, I think it's hard to get it through the Senate spending more money with inflation at 8.6%. I believe it's going to be very hard to get Kyrsten Sinema with tax hikes. And you know who else is out there? You got Maggie Hassan upside down in New Hampshire. Raphael Warnock clinging to a polling lead, which I don't believe is real. You've got Mark Kelly, who's going to be up against either Brnovich or Blake Masters in the Senate race. You've got and you've got Cortez Masa, who's is losing to Adam Laxalt in some polls. They don't want to vote on this nonsense 4 months before an election, and actually 2 months before the votes start going out.
I think that's probably right. I mean, I don't know about them specifically. I don't have any reporting that would indicate where they are at this point. But I think what you highlight is difficult. I mean, even if you're just hiking taxes for quote unquote rich people, it's just difficult. I mean, there's pass through entities. There's all sorts of things. There's all sorts of ways that Republicans will say that you're raising taxes in a soft economy.
Now, you also cover the fact that the final two hearings of the 1-6, Nancy Pelosi's 1-6 committee are coming up. I must tell you, as an objective matter, having just been in Ohio for 3 days, Trumbull and Mahoning County, the Steel Valleys, voted reliably Democrats from 1972 and 2016. They are now deep in Trump country. I mean, you can't go anywhere and not see Trump signs. If the 1-6 gathering, and it's not really a traditional select committee, and I do not credit it with any due process whatsoever, but if they intended to move the needle, they only moved the MAGA people into ultra MAGA people, as I saw one T-shirt wearing neighbor of my brother. Oh, I'm ultra MAGA. I don't think they did a thing to his perception among his base.
Yeah, I don't have any idea about what the political fallout or implications of this are. But I think we tend to overrate what moves people. I think I do agree that most people are going to be voting on the economy. I think that's the reality. But I do think there are people who are interested in the comings and goings of the January 6th committee. Now, will they vote on that? Who knows? I have no idea. But, I tend to agree with you that it has not moved a ton of people, or there's not at this point evidence that it's moved a ton of people.
Now, I will tell you, people are interested. I sat down with six old friends on Friday night for dinner. And one of them, a great lawyer in Cleveland, Notre Dame grad, Catholic as long, asked about it twice. And I said, look, Liz is not happy with me because I know Congresswoman Cheney pretty well. And she's not happy with me because I just don't cover it on the show because people will turn off the radio show. They don't want to know about it because they don't trust it. They don't believe in it. But Democrats do. This is our divided country, Jake. I don't think we're at the precipice of civil war, but there are two medias. There are two narratives. There are two sets of people. You're one of the few people try to cover both and I think are respected by both. And I try to do so as well. But I honestly don't think they've changed a single mind. They've just deepened already held perceptions of the former president.
I think that on the edges, that's true. I don't think there's any question about that. Listen, it's difficult to get people. In my view personally, I was there on January 6th. I think what happened was pretty clear. And I think we're hearing from the committee we're hearing from people who were close to the president in their own words. That to me is worthwhile, and I think that for history is a worthwhile endeavor. But I do agree with you that people look at it as being partisan. There's no question about it.
And not fair, fundamentally unfair. Now, I want to ask you about the Hunter Biden laptop I'm not up to speed on this. Dwayne briefed me on it this morning because I spent yesterday celebrating 40 years of wedded bliss. And evidently 4chan did a dump of everything on the Biden laptop. And it's awful and it's terrible. And I look, and so I go to my Google News. Nobody is covering what 4chan put up. Nobody. What's that tell you?
I don't know what it tells me. I can tell you we're focused on governing and legislating, and it's just not been something with a small staff that we've dug into.
So here's the question. If there is, as some people online say, material that suggests Hunter Biden is compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, does that become a news story that focuses, that touches governing? Because Mitch McConnell has said we're not passing the U.S.-China Act if you pass reconciliation. So China is on the table right now. And if Hunter Biden has a China relationship, and I don't know that he does, because I don't do this either. I mean, it's just right. So you could end up in a rabbit warren in about 5 seconds. You could go down a hole that takes you into conspiracy land. So I just wait for the story to bubble up in the Post or the Times or a mainstream media outlet. But would it ever cross your radar? Because there will be a special committee on this.
It would cross my radar if Republicans take the majority, which we assume they will, and then they launch an investigation into something like this. That's when it would cross my personal radar. Until then, we just don't have the bandwidth. I mean, I'd love to have, I don't know if I'd love to have a million people working for me, but if I had more people working for me, maybe it would be a different story. But until it kind of crosses into the Capitol, it's not in our lane.
Jake, when you get to 40 years of punchbowlnews.com, you will have a million people working for you. So
goodness,
what anniversary did you, the one that I wasn't invited to, what anniversary party was that?
That was the first anniversary.
That was the first. And then maybe I'll be at the second one, but I'm telling you, you want to go 40 years, just keep doing what you're doing. Punchbowl News America. You should get in your email every morning. It's free. If you want the other stuff, you got to subscribe, but punchbowlnews.com is free. Be right back on the anniversary edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.